Welcome to Lili Logic. My name is Lisa Smith Henderson, and I am the host of Lili Logic. If you're wondering where Lili comes from, that was my childhood nickname. It's also my grandmother name, and it's really me without the radio Christy Tanner persona. It's just straight up me. So you may hear me cuss a little bit. And I am also, if you want to go to the website, lililogic.com, you can find other podcasts and resources there. But I am so excited today to have my dear friend Yen from Singapore with me. Welcome.
Hello. Hello. I'm just excited. I'm just excited to be chatting with you on
me too.
A podcast. Yeah.
Yes. And Yen, since I've known you, I knew that you had a partner who died. And when my husband died, you've been a great resource for me. And we've shared about it. And you're ahead of me. Michael died 2 years ago. Nick died 6 years ago. So tell me a little bit about what it was like for you at the very beginning.
Shock. Pure shock. No, I can tell you that exact moment where I actually got the news, because I actually got a phone call at 2:30 in the morning. And when you get a phone call from the hospital at that time, you kind of know what it is. And I was on go mode, just on autopilot, just on automatic, which was functioning, and maybe you could say functioning quite effectively, which is not a word you want to use when it comes to death, because I had already been dealing with doing the palliative. And I still remember having this voice saying, "Have you called his family yet?" And they're like, "No, not yet. Would you like me to? And I still remember this robotic anger that I had, and in my mind thinking, "I mean, you have to ask me this question," which thankfully I didn't say out loud. So there was immediate anger, immediate shock.
Do you think it's better, because I knew Michael was sick for a very short period of time. I think you knew Nick was sick for longer. Do you think it's easier than when it's a sudden death?
I've always thought that it is easier, the knowledge of having that runway and actually having space, just being in the same room as him, and to remember how he navigated that death, and to see how he treated all his other friendships, relationship with family, such kindness and strength. That helped.
And you got to say goodbye.
Yes. Yes. I got to say goodbye and know that this is just one phase. Nick and I were both pretty open. And the goodbye process sometimes isn't about the words. Sometimes it's just about being with each other.
And how did you cope afterwards? What were some of your coping mechanisms, healthy and unhealthy?
Oh, I'm so glad that you added the last subcategories there. I can immediately recite to you things which I did. Firstly, a lot of reading. I'm reading about research on grief and the field. It's so clinical. Once again, so clinical. Secondly, I just dropped myself into work. And thirdly, because of the literature that I read, I thought that this is something that one could be effective in terms of grieving and effective. And I was so efficient. By the time it came to Boxing Day on the 26th of December, I had already met someone at someone's party. And that was not the first date I had.
So this was like 2 weeks after he died? Two to three weeks?
But yeah, 3 weeks. Basically 3 weeks. I really counted it that way. But now that you say 2 to 3 weeks, it makes it even shorter. And after that, I just felt, okay, I just have to get on with it. And here is someone who's paying attention to the poor widower. And then in January, asking him out for dinner, he was asking. And me, I just bent myself into whatever shape that I thought other people wanted, which I was quite proficient at. But that didn't help me.
Did you think you were over the grief when you had this date?
I had no thinking whatsoever. I was not thinking about the grief. This is how I grieve. How I grieve was basically feeling as though I had to reassure people that I was okay, so that I wasn't a burden to them, and to make sure that other people were okay, that his in-laws were okay. They're very stoic people, so of course they'd be okay. But his friends, some of his friends were really, really, you know, some were emotionally, I would say, dependent on them, because he had a thing for underdogs. So to make sure they were okay, some of his healthy friends, they dealt with it in a healthy manner. The others, they didn't get a chance to say goodbye to him. And me, I somehow took it upon myself to check if they were okay, when it's really not my grief, not my responsibility. But back then, I thought that was what one did. You know, just made sure everything was okay, as if this was the palliative care ward, to make sure everyone right. else was okay, except myself.
And I don't think we're really taught this. Okay, when you grieve, it's your grief. I did tell my children that. I said, I love you. I know you're grieving, and I cannot take care of you in this grief. I'm in my own deep grief right now, and I can't help you, man.
Yeah.
The one person I was so worried about, Michael had a twin, and I was so concerned about her. And I think, you know, everybody has their own process, and I kind of forgot that.
Oh my goodness. So you can see where I'm coming from. And also at that point in time, I had no concept of what codependency was. Supposed to do certain things as a good partner, as a good friend, as a good family member as well. And I'm not even a mom, you know, I'm not even a spouse, and I so I already kind of feel this need to look, to put aside my emotions and then look out for everyone else. So I cannot imagine what someone like as a caregiver, as a primary caregiver.
It was really nice because my children had the opportunity to take care of me. And I allowed them to do that. And that was really different, because I was one of these moms like, I do for you, I do for you, I do for you. Doesn't matter, you're grown up, I will do for you. And in that space, I was wearing sweatpants all the time, which I never do. I mean, Yen, you've known me, you know, I dress up.
I cannot imagine you in sweatpants.
Yeah. I was, and at Christmas, Michael died in November. At Christmas, my daughter gave me some nice sweatpants. And she goes, Mom, if you're going to be in sweatpants, you need to wear something cute. And I thought, oh God, I must be like, I still was putting on makeup, but I was depressed. I didn't want to leave. I was afraid to drive because I was so dissociated. And I felt like, I'm going to have a wreck because I can't pay attention. So I stayed home a lot. And let me ask you, when you had that date, did you feel guilty or like ashamed?
Yeah, of course I did. But what else did I do? I just shoved it to one side, like all the other emotions. I was in denial about the fact that I was in denial. There is no better way to deny something than to cover it up with other stronger sensations based on neurotransmitters of all hormones that are that make one feel good because of the connection with someone else, whether emotional, trauma bonding, or sexual. Blame anyone who kind of came my direction. I don't say, you know, I never say things like, oh, they should have been smarter. I used to blame myself a lot after 3 years of doing that unhealthy coping mechanism. I never had the grace to kind of let go and be okay with showing people that I was not okay. I wasn't taught that, you know, I'm so happy that your family got to see you go through that process, and I'm sure it would have, you know, they were adults by then. That's how we influence and learn from each other, isn't it? It's not from what we tell each other, it's from how we see someone else with really tough life circumstances.
Well, I promptly went on to be a poor example because I started dating somebody 3 months after Michael died, and my daughter was not happy. I mean, she was just like, you threw Michael away like a piece of tissue. You know, what was he to you? And I couldn't explain to her, like, I felt alive. I wasn't feeling this horrible raw pain. And I was basically, I wasn't using drugs or alcohol, but I was using somebody else to make me feel better.
I mean, how strong are those feelings? You know, that feeling of freshness, novelty, anticipation, just moving into something else, you know?
Dopamine. Good God. Dopamine.
Just get it over, get the past over and done with and move into this bright shining light without realizing that I'm a moth and the light is actually this burning gas lamp that's gonna just singe my wings. Yeah.
And what about food? Did you use food?
No, I used the opposite of food.
Oh, exercise. Oh, so you started working out like extra?
I started doing everything extra. I started doing budgeting extra, working extra, exercising extra, dating extra in between all these short-term relationships because it'd be so extra. And this is how, apart from it being not helpful for me in terms of giving space for grieving, this is how it's unfair for other people as well. And I totally own it now. Coming across as being more available than I actually am. Because when I put on that front end, it's do, I get mostly burnt out. And I sort of make like nonverbal promises that I will be there, I can be open and intimate. And then it gets too intimate, what I do. I feel like this is too much. It's too extra. But it's extra because of my own doing, you know. It's run away. I'm so sorry, numbers 1, 2, 3. Okay. I had 6 in total short-term 2 relationships. And so...
Did you break 6 hearts?
No. I think the next 3, they were the ones who broke my heart. So it was the reverse. Somehow this whole journey has come in 3s. I have no idea why. So 3, I didn't even give them the respect to say, I'm not ready yet at the start. I just sort of became unavailable and did the worst thing one could ever do, the most disrespectful thing. And I say that without shaming myself. It's like not caring about, just leave them in the dust, just suddenly go, slowly becoming incommunicado. It's like, how rude is that?
Ghosting, basically. Yeah, and it's very tricky. I mean, somebody said to me, oh, he should have known better. You were so vulnerable. And I was like, I was all in. I was all in, man. Yeah. I was like, this is somebody I've had the hots for 40 years, and we were never able to be together. I was like, oh, this is meant to be. And I turned it into, obviously, something it wasn't, but it felt good. And I was doing, I spent the first 3 months being so mad at my husband, which I hadn't been, because this guy was telling me, oh, you're beautiful, you're amazing, you know, you're this, you're that. And I was like, Michael never told me any of those things. The difference was my husband showed up for me and was there for me. And I had to kind of go through that being mad stage, which now I look at the stages of grief, the anger, denial, acceptance, bargaining, anger. And I don't remember what the other one is, the 5 stages.
A depression, actually, sadness and depression is 1 stage. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not meant to be in order.
And then Butterfingers and Cheetos, those were my coping mechanisms.
Hey, you know, I think that is also basically that drive for more. And it could be through flavor, because nothing gets those taste buds like what fats and sugar can do. And this one I totally can relate as well. I never got into that. But it's like that, isn't that what addiction is about? Finding something that kind of takes away the overwhelm.
Mm-hmm.
Takes away the things that will maybe crumble and then needing more.
And Yin, here's my philosophy, and I want to know if you found this to be true in your case. There is no escaping the grief.
Yep. Some people might show it. Some people might not show it. And usually people don't show their grieving process, which I hope we give each other space for that. You know, not just on this podcast, you know, because of I tell you, this podcast is going to be messy. but I think the messiness to me is to be embraced as well. The only reason why I feel like I can actually share about these things with you, even if we're talking one-on-one. It's because I can actually face the process of grief myself without the shame.
Yes. I mean, I ended up breaking up with this guy, and the grief was there waiting for me. That's the thing when people go, you're avoiding your grief. I'm like, oh, your grief will catch up. I don't think we ever have to worry about that. It may take years. It may take months. The grief catches up and we do process it eventually.
Only if we give ourselves time. It was, and even give us, not by my own volition, mind. It was just, the pain was just so overwhelming. So I got into a really deep period of calling suicide hotlines. Can I say that word, suicide?
Hell yeah, that's the truth.
Yeah, for 2.5 weeks, and to the point where I would remember the voices of certain volunteers because I was calling multiple times. I didn't know what to do. If I do not sit with it, if I do not sit with emptiness, with that emptiness, and allow the grief to come in, grief is going to be waiting on the porch. It's going to be just sitting there in summer, in the dead of winter, in the cold. It's going to be there. It's going to be in the corner. It's going to be under your bed, under my bed.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me, too, is watching how people grieve differently.
Yep,
like,
yep.
Everybody does it differently. So I think it's like, oh, okay. And all of a sudden, for me, I had been partnered since I was 17, pretty much. And all of a sudden, here I was in my 60s thinking, what if I never have a man again? And that's when I hit the suicidal place, is like, do I want to live if I don't ever have a romantic partner again? I did. I decided I did. You know, I took a week and really did some deep diving in therapy and really had to get clear, like, yes, my life is worth living with or without a man. Do I prefer that? Not really.
You know, I think when it comes to how coping, dysfunctional coping mechanism will be different for every one of us, and how healthy healing, very individual. I think that's really shaped by one, our genetic predisposition and our temperament. All of that comes into like close contact with whatever we faced in our childhoods if we didn't learn those skills, if they weren't modeled for us. And on top of that, if we were in dynamics that maybe certain ways of dealing with things in a way which actually did deal with things, which was the case in my household. Yeah, get over it or don't. What that did in my case was that it attached another level and a greater element of shame to any feeling that I had. Feel sad about something? Don't. So the message to me then is, do not feel sad. Because imagine that every time you came up with like anger or sadness, or like, or joy, you know, it's like, and the message is like, don't. Over time, it's like, if I ever feel these things, that's bad. And I'm bad because I feel these things, which is, I think I need to break through all of that. And when you said that sentence about grief will always be there, I think the bigger message for me was that emotions and feelings will always be there. And this has been a very recent journey of not just having the right emotions, but loving all of them, learning to love myself, even if I had emotions that I really felt so ashamed of. And shame is so violent. Shame doesn't come in a scolding voice all the time. Shame sometimes comes in a smile when one feels like crying. I did a bloody TEDx youth talk on grief 1 year after. I mean, I look back at it, I'm like, please.
How cool, though.
It was cool. At the same time, and, you know, from this vantage point, I think 1 year later, you know, there was more space for the grief. 1 year later, I had not done the grieving process yet.
Do you wish you had done anything differently afterwards?
Yes.
Oh, you do? Yeah. You really do?
I say this with the total acceptance and embrace and also gratitude. When I say that I would have done things differently, I also feel an equal amount of gratitude for the journey that I went through. You cannot have choice without the risk of regret. So I'm actually okay with regret, as long as I know that that is there to just show me things. It's just light. What do I? It teaches me. It teaches me what I value. It teaches me what matters. Yeah.
Say a little bit more about that. Like, let's say it was today. You know everything that you know. What would you do differently?
Oh, what would I do differently? Firstly, I would give myself a lot more space. And the space can be a daily space, which means a lot of rest. The body needs a lot of time to do nothing. It needs time to go, to force itself to shut down. I would have embraced depression a lot more. Not chased depression, because it's the worst feeling in the world, but understood that that was my body's way of saying, yeah, I'm going to put a hard emergency brake on life right now. And during this time, take this time to be with yourself and show yourself a lot of care and love, because it's nothing you can do for anything outside of you until you show yourself love. I wish I, instead of learning how to grieve effectively, I wish I had learned that there was no right way of doing things.
Yes.
The only reason why I was looking for the right way of doing things was because it was painful. I wish I had sat with the pain. I wish I had given space for that pain, because that is quite a space for the pain. And I learned those things.
And there's nothing like that rawness. After someone first dies, it's like, I kind of get, do whatever you have to do to get through that. Because when I broke up with this man and the grief from my husband was still waiting, it wasn't that raw, just every fiber of my being is on fire.
Okay, tell me more about that. That was such a sensorial, kind of evocative description.
I was a mess. I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know how to be. I didn't know how to be alone. I didn't even know what I really liked or what I wanted. I was like, well, what did I used to like? So I thought, well, I used to like music. So I started going to concerts. And I would go with this guy, but I would also go by myself. And so I started exploring what I liked, but I was doing anything to just take that raw pain down a notch. And I have to say, it did keep me alive. Like somebody that I loved very, 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 very deeply was killed by a drunk driver when I was in my 20s. And I was still drinking and drugging and acting out in my sex and love addiction. It saved my life. Had I not had something that dramatic to help me cope, I would have jumped off a bridge. So in a way, I guess, you know, I'm glad, I'm sorry I had to become an alcoholic and a drug addict and go, oh yeah, this needs to stop. But it kept me alive. And so I kind of am looking at this pain, that raw grief pain, as there's only so much one can tolerate, you know, and whether it's going to a silly movie or having escapist sex or eating a bag of Cheetos. It's kind of like, hey, whatever it takes.
At that point in time, I would agree. And I think here, after hearing what you said, when it came time for me to reconnect with those who I knew were long time friends, who were always there waiting in the wings, waiting for me to come out of my shell, waiting for me to be vulnerable, to share with them. Because if I'm totally fine, there's nothing that anyone can do, and no one's looking to do anything for me, I was still going on rails, like running on adrenaline.
And if you were going to give advice to somebody, so you're 6 years out, and I imagined you've done an awful lot of processing and probably are at a point where you have really good memories and fond feelings. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
So let's say you're talking to somebody who's lost a partner last week. If you had somebody to tell you, hey, here's what you can expect, and I've got a tip for you, what would it be?
I would actually tell them that I was there for them based on just simple presence. Because nothing communicates more than just being there, being open, and just listening in a way that doesn't take on anyone else's feelings, that doesn't show any discomfort someone else's feeling. There is one message there, which is you're going through all of that, and that's okay. You are not a different person. It is painful now. Let's sit with that. And while you're sitting with that, know that you're not alone. And if you cannot hear this, then let me just be with you, which is the space of conversation, is the space to take away the shame that sometimes drives the fear. The feeling of fear, I cannot, and the feeling of badness, that guilt, which adds to the fear, which lets us not talk, not feel, not grieve, which further adds to the covering and hiding and silence and the shame. So one step is taking away the veil of fear and guilt about messiness. Yeah.
And having you as a friend, as I mean, you know, when I first met you, Michael was alive and well, and then he died, and you've been such a great source of comfort in that I knew you had gone through the same thing. You had loved someone and you lost them, and you could share with me where you were. And I find it with my sister. I mean, she's like, well, I'm a year behind you. And it does help to be like, oh, okay. Now I'm going to be at this jumping off point. Eventually, I might be at the top of the mountain where I can see the whole view. But right now, I'm on a ledge.
Yeah.
I thank you for your witnessing and support.
Let's put it this way. I'm glad that we're on this climb together, because maybe there isn't a top. Maybe it's just gaining higher ground. And at each point, appreciating the fact that we have a better view of things. But while we're climbing, that's doing helping each other along the way and not needing rush. I think that meeting you was serendipitous, and I'm super grateful for that. Whatever brought us in contact with each other, and you sharing your journey with me as well. So that has helped.
Thank you, yeah. Yin. Oh, that's such a perfect way to leave it, with that idea of we just keep climbing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I like that. No, thank you. Even if this didn't turn into a podcast, I'd be happy. I'd be grateful for what we chatted
Me
about.
Me too. And I always feel that with you, but just, yeah, to have carved out this space. And I will say, if you're grieving, it does get better. It does get easier. And just take very good care of yourself. My thanks to Yin for being here. Lily Logic is the name of the podcast, available on all of your favorite platforms. And you can find out more by going to lilylogic.com. See you next time.